Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 70, section 6, which is old single column, page 789. Okay. Let's see, I suppose before we just jump right into this next section, think about what they gave us just immediately prior here. And recall they started the paper out with those two big sections on war, and then they gave us the sweep through the basic budding of group manifestation. A basic societal manifestation. And when it starts out in that very amorphous state, it's the horde. And then you begin to get the nucleation of families out of that, you know, mist of nothingness, sort of. And then you get clans going, those consanguineous clans, and then the clans begin to come together for the greater good, you know, as it were, into tribes. And, you know, we're pointing towards subsequently nations and then full-on territorial states, you know, states with laws. In contrast to just nations with mores. But none of these, remember how one of the things we noticed is none of these initial states get totally left behind. Especially initially, there are clans within the tribe. You know, literally still clans within the tribe. But you are in, an activating principle of tribalism instead of clanism. Okay, slowly, inexorably over time, those older structures do melt away in any sort of a literal expression. But like we mentioned, you obviously always are going to have subgroups, subsets. You're not going to just totally wash away and have a purely uniform phenomenon. There's always going to be internal structure. So you have clan-like elements. You know, even if you don't literally have clans, you know, one could say. So that's and they were in the section in section 5, they were just pointing out the beginnings of moving towards having three branches of government: executive, legislative, judicial, and that the executive branch forms first, and legislative and judicial come later on. Remember how you start out with that council of the elders, and you know that the council begins to serve as the legislative and judicial, if not also the cabinet for the executive branch. And so you can see when we go into section 6, we're talking about getting a very definitive executive in place, and. And then way down the road, you'll get the legislative and judicial, and especially way down the road, you'll actually separate the judicial from the legislative. And so just one little thought about that process again. When I pointed out like that, you know, executive first, and then, you know, legislative, yeah, it's got judicial blended in. And then last, you finally get a definitively separated judicial branch. That sequence, executive, legislative, judicial, does that remind you of a sequence? Right, as you move up in the local universe. Right, the lowest level, the local system level, is the executive. Next level up, the constellation is the legislative. The top level, the local universe headquarters level, is the judicial. See, that's why it evolves in that order. You're literally, the society is conceptualizing in an ascending fashion until finally it ascends all the way up to a recognition of the local universe headquarters level separation from it all just being pooled together in that beginning state where you don't even have families of the horde. So that's just, you know, to notice. I mean, there's no one in human history that is even remotely thought of why that sequence is there. But you can notice it. It's like, yeah. We're not just blobs of protoplasm randomly bouncing around. Right? There's obviously a purposing, a very subtle purposing that's imposed upon us through the evolutionary process. And the patterns on high slowly but surely manifest down below through that creative process, that temporal creative process, evolution. Evolution in all ways, not just biologic. Everything evolves. Okay, so let's get into section six here and see what they give us see if we can immediately strike step with what the truth is, you know, in contrast to merely the historical facts that they're giving us.
Section six, monarchical government. Effective state rule only came with the arrival of a chief with full executive authority. Man found that effective government could be had only by conferring power on a personality, not by endowing an idea.
Okay, so this little nugget, two sentences, making a paragraph. Did they say only? Yes, in both paragraphs, or both sentences in the paragraph. Okay. Executive state rule only came. Man found that effective government could be had only. Okay. Notice that one of the things that we're losing in the so-called modern times is that long, arduous evolutionary discovery of those onlys. You know, and we got lots of people thinking, you know, that's just some sort of random, arbitrary thing that, you know, there must have been some vast conspiracy or something that put it in place. No. Okay? And the moment that you go away from that, thinking that you can have some, remember how that was another thing in the preceding section, that you could have some debating society, be ultimately in charge, and that it could somehow lead in a definitive way. No. Man found that effective government. Yeah, you'll have government, sort of, until it finally just all implodes under its own weight. But you know, you're not going to get effective government. You need that point individual. And again, this is not something that humans are dreaming up. This is the pattern on high. How many creator sons are at the head of a local universe? 100? Like the Senate? No. One. go to the executive level, the local system level. Are there many system sovereigns? No, there's one system sovereign.
Are there many
engines of days? Well, see, that's different. And that's an important thing. Right. You go, well, yeah, what if you go up beyond the local universe, all of a sudden you see at the top there's three. Yeah, because that's a totally different phenomenon that we aren't remotely up to yet. But you can notice that eventually Trinity teacher sons come to a world, right? as that world begins to be guided to transcend a mere local universe sort of parochialism, one might say. Even though that's a little hard for us to wrap our minds around, because for us the local universe is so vast. But in the grand scheme of things, a local universe is a very, very circumscribed fact, very limited relative to the total finite. And worlds have to become part of something much more general than something as specific as a local universe, as limited as a master sun. I mean, you can say it in various ways like that to really drive the point home of just, you know, how transcendent things, you know, get on a world. You know, think about a world in the seventh stage of light and life. How far beyond the limited relationship to the total finite that our master sun has, that you know, this world will have when we're in the seventh stage of light and life. Way, way, way beyond such a limited scope. A creator son is God, and of course, a master son is just God in an even greater way, but not infinite by any means. Okay, so, but again, back to the story here. See, there's a number of basic, you know, truths that you can recognize by just keeping your contemplation of the historical facts in the cosmic context, you know, by looking for the cosmic pattern below, as above, so below, right? The pattern inexorably comes down through the evolutionary process, and so, in basically all its details. So, our challenge as students of the fifth epical revelation is to not be caught up or get sucked into the so-called conventional wisdom of the day, because it's not wisdom, and becoming less and less wise with each passing decade. We're over 100 years down the road now into the endarkenment relative to wisdom. There's almost no wisdom left in so-called conventional wisdom. So, it's just conventional ignorance called conventional wisdom now. And the fifth epical revelation is trying to teach us these things, you know, and to let yourself be challenged. You know, it's not just to inspire you religiously. Sure, it can do that in spades more than anything that you can find anywhere in all of human history. I mean, even more than Jesus inspired people when he was here in the flesh, you know, doing his public ministry, say. A lot more here. But, you know, it's not merely that. A little cattle prod for your religious consciousness. It's trying to challenge, you know, your thoughts about government and science and history and paleontology and everything.
Family.
Yeah. All right. So that's the very fact that they repeat that only. It doesn't take much reflecting on that limited number of words in that little paragraph for you to go, I'm noticing something. What are they trying to teach me there? And, how many people remember this? How many people are basically falling into the Lucifer rebellion, you know, and saying, you know, I'm not going to be, you know, put myself underneath some chief executive. I mean, who does he think he is? Lucifer told me I have liberty.
There's good chief.
Right. But the tricky part is at what point is a bad chief executive better than no chief executive?
Oh, that's true.
There's all those tricky things, you know, that you have to, you know, there's some line there where literally you know, yeah, it's not the greatest chief executive, but it's still better than none, the anarchism of none. You know, and when you're just in the material comfort era, you're not going to have chief executives like you can envision, you know, we'll have in the light and life.
Okay? Probably got stockholders and board directors that replace them.
All right. So anyway. Yeah, and we're actually going to read about that, what those the stockholders and board of directors replacing CEOs, you know, how that's of an extension of what was done in the old days. I mean, hopefully the board doesn't use poison like they did in the old days. But all right, but I'm jumping ahead. Let's keep going here.
Rulership grew out of the idea of family authority or wealth. When a patriarchal kinglet became a real king, he was sometimes called father of his people. Later on, kings were thought to have sprung from heroes. And still further on, rulership became hereditary due to belief in the divine origin of kings.
And you're going, the divine origin of kings. Yeah, but think about what I was just saying. Right, where did this pattern come from? I see they're super consciously humans know these things. And it trickles down into the conscious level as some kind of simplistic, often childish expression. But there's a thread of truth there. Right? The patterns below do have a divine origin. As above, so below. So you can see, you know, and see they're pointing out the sequence. As time goes on, you get a more and more definitive attempt to have a conscious notion tied to that vague truth that you're aware of superconsciously. Yeah, and you can see the sequence that they're giving you there, from kinglet to king to, you know, then having the king sprung from heroes and then finally sprung from the heavens. Yeah. The key here is also to think about the word king literally. King is a contraction of the older full word kin-ing, where that ing suffix was indicating that what's associated with it, like in this case, kin, that you have that certain or that specific type or kind, right? So, if you want to know what kind of kin we are, say the old people under a monarchical government, if you want to know what kind-ing of kin we are, look to the archetype of our kin, the kin-ing, right, the king. Right, that's the whole point of that word, that he's meant to embody, you know, just the purest essence of everything that is noble and good about that people, and they're all going to look up to this, like, wow, I've got little shades of that. But, oh, he has it in spades, you know, in every direction. That's the whole point. Is the person that you make king is this archetype of your people, the kin-ing. So you're going from something with shades of that, the kinglet, right, to a real king. And notice they even use the word real to point how, even though there's not a lot of consciousness, like I was saying, of the higher things going on, there nonetheless is a reality. We are talking about persons that are doing this, persons that are being subject to this evolutionary process. Superconsciously, at least, there is reality in play. And there's a lot there.
What about
queens? Well, we're going to get to that in a second about why you don't have an ing thing with the queen, yes. Okay, so what do they give us here next? They're picking up on that hereditary concept here.
Hereditary kingship avoided the anarchy, which had previously wrought such havoc between the death of a king and the election of a successor. The family had a biologic head, the clan a selected natural leader. The tribe and later state had no natural leader, and this was an additional reason for making the chief kings hereditary. The idea of royal families and aristocracy was also based on the mores of name ownership in the clans.
So maybe just pick up on that last thought first. You know, like I was saying at the beginning in my little preface, the clan thing doesn't just evaporate. It's still literally there to begin with as subgroups within the tribe. And you begin to generalize some of the sort of the most cherished elements of clan consciousness, you know, into the tribal context. So, you know, that whole bit of what's your clan name, right, goes up to, you know, basically the idea that the line of kings is a clan, see, you know, with a particular name. Yeah, it's a House of Windsor or whatever, right?
The Tudors, or whatever, right?
Right. See, so they're, you know, just, you know, very few things literally just disappear. They evolve into some new form and keep going and going and going. So you see that over and over again, and then. You know, like they were pointing out, or like we were pointing out, I mean, a minute ago, the anarchy things, you know, that's, it doesn't take long for humans to have unpleasant experiences with anarchy to figure out that's not a great idea. You know, and that's one of the earliest things that are learned. So again, you know, when you have people thinking, oh, if we could only have the light and life of anarchism, you know, again, it's completely... 180 degrees turned around and all the way back to the horde square one mess to think like that. Very, very unfortunate thoughts in supposedly progressive-minded individuals. Let's see. One other little thing. You notice that they're throwing in the word aristocracy. Again, you know, the literalness of words, it's always handy, you know, as you're reading and you have a little bit, you know, fancier word like that, you don't know the literal meaning, look it up. It's often illuminating to think about why the revelators selected that word. You know, that's the rule of the best. And, you know, you notice that it's, they're not going to be using it as some drippingly negative word like we tend to invoke it today. The very fact that you, like I said, that you have the concept of a kin-ing, right? He's the best of the best. He is the archetype. You can't even imagine a better specimen of our tribe than that. Right? Everyone acknowledges his superior status in every way, shape, and form. And that's why he's king. But you've got a whole subgroup of the best of the tribe. And that are in orbit about the kin-ing and about the king. So just think about that concept of aristocracy and how much difficulty we have with these hierarchical words because we don't recognize how much we've been influenced by the sophistries of the Lucifer Rebellion. You know, none of us stood in a big amphitheater and listened to Lucifer hold forth, and yet it's like we did. Right? It's like he was preaching from the mountaintop yesterday and everyone heard it. And I'm going, oh, that's a great idea. They're very seductive, these ideas. And we come upon them just as he did. You know, no one preached to him. He figured it out in his own head. And we can go the same path, the pathology of Lucifer. So we have to recognize that it's a hierarchical phenomenon. Michael is better than we are, right? But Lucifer couldn't stomach that thought, that someone was better than him, right? These are just foreign potentates, right? They're just like me, but, you know, they're claiming that they're way above me. Says who? Notice the tension that you probably feel when you just read the word aristocracy. Think about, where's that tension coming from? Who put that tension in your head? Who made you think, I'm not going to allow for someone to be better than me? My mind is innately divine.
Subordinate.
Just think about where that comes from.
Fear.
Yeah.
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 And grouped with some intelligence of history,
mm-hmm.
and people just, they lose, as you say, yeah. the understanding of trust. Because really, the best haven't always been the king, that's what. Yeah, the king, maybe that's true.
That's a great point. Okay, I'm really glad you brought that up to help clarify what I was just saying. You could say, Chris, but what about all of the very unfortunate examples of kings or aristocracy where they abuse the situation? Yes, right. There's always been this problem, and they're going to bring it up in a second here. But why wasn't there an emergency way back when there was just as much problem of some corrupt leader taking advantage of the power and the position that was given to him? Why is it now there's an emergency?
See, I didn't mean that, but
I know you did, but you made me think of that. It's a very important to recognize there's something different about what's going on now than in the past. It appears to be the same. Same old corrupt leaders. Right? It's always been that way. You can read the oldest historical documents. They were bemoaning that. There wasn't an emergency 4,000 years ago or something. Why is there an emergency now? See, and it's what I was just pointing out, because there's a different, subtle, basically unrecognized energy in play with this now, where you're not recognizing, well, unfortunately, that was a wise leader, but that doesn't mean there can't be, that was an unwise leader, but that doesn't mean there can't be wise leaders. But more and more, it's like, now we conclude that because this leader is unwise, there is no such thing as wise leaders, that's a delusion. I don't know why we ever even imagined that. We should just reject the concept of leaders and go to anarchy. Flatten it all down to the plane. No hierarchy, right? Anarchy, right? Instead of hierarchy. See, that basic, very ignorant conclusion or thought process, like the silliness of skepticism. Right, where the basic thought that skepticism is founded on is that because falsehood exists, therefore truth does not exist. See, that's the same thing I'm just bringing up. Many, many different.
I'm saying if evil exists, good
exists. right. You could obviously, the examples are infinite. Right. Notice how often humans do that.
How could you recognize that fallacies exist if you didn't have some relationship to truth?
Right. I mean, it's just so inherently illogical, the thought, in so many ways, that for someone to countenance it, they have to have completely cut themselves off from their human quality of mind, from the insights of the three cosmic intuitions, from their encirclement in the Holy Spirit and their personal nature. I mean, only a fancy animal could be satisfied with a thought like that. No human could countenance a thought like that. It's just so absurd. Right? You know, and yet you go, wow, but yeah, some of the smartest people to ever live, you know, adopted skepticism. Yeah, see, just because they're really smart doesn't mean they're functioning like a human. They're just a fancy animal, and their thought proves it. Right? You know, or think about another, you know, the most self-evident fact in all of existence. The existence of God, right? Tells you point blank in the book. There isn't anything that's more trivially self-evident to a human mind than the existence of God. Think about how many people see not, they'll have no feeling in their mind that that's a self-evident fact. In other words, they have no human feeling in their mind. That's just a fancy animal. That's the only a fancy animal could think there isn't a God. No human can. Right? Now, it doesn't mean they're subhuman. See, but they're effectively, you know, literally subhuman, but they might as well, because they're not availing themselves of any of their human consciousness. Where the existence of God is absolutely trivially self-evident. Right? To the simplest human mind. Okay? Human mind.
Suppress your humanity and make it a potential only.
Yeah, right. You're a human in name only, see. You know, you take delight in name ownership. I'm a human. Show me some proof. You know, by your fruits, I only by your fruits can I know you. I see no sign of human consciousness in you. You're devoid of logical recognition and everything else that's human. Yep.
God exists is because of the hierarchy.
Well, and see, no, there's no reasoning process. You know, the existence of God is just a self-evident fact with no antecedents. You just know that if you have the third cosmic intuition functioning. I mean, if you don't know that, I mean, all right.
God help you.
Right? It just, see, that's, you know, it's not something you conclude. It's just something you know.
Spiritual insight.
It's an initial thought, not a subsequent thought. It's not predicated on anything. Right? I mean, in you, now, technically, okay, so it's predicated on you being encircled in the Holy Spirit so that you can have self-evident consciousness. Right. It's predicated on grace, but in terms of your awareness, there are no antecedents to certain things. Those are the things of the three cosmic intuitions. Those are the things of your human foundation, where you just know something. Right? It must be. Yeah.
So when Jesus was talking to the guy, and he said, "You know, I'm trying to teach me how to find God," and Jesus came back and said, "Well, God's already found you. Your problem is you just don't know who God is." And I think a lot of people today, I mean, mm-hmm. we all come across them all the time that are either, you know, agnostic or don't really believe in God, don't have an understanding of who God is. You know, mm-hmm. they do have, and when you get in talking to them more in depth, their understanding of what they think of God is, you know, a little bit more on the line of things that you read in the Urantia book that you know the spiritual aspect, but not, you know, like not the gray-haired guy sitting on a throne, so to speak, mm-hmm. whom a lot of people have been taught, so to
sure.
speak, you know what I mean? That's their image, so to
yeah,
speak.
Right.
They put the human image there, too.
Yeah.
That's another reason, as you say, why this book in your lap
mm-hmm.
needs to get out of your lap. You know, so people need to have an understanding.
Right.
Like, remember all of us before we got in touch with the book, what our concept of God was.
Yeah, you're not going to make an impression upon someone else's life by picking up a book and looking over your glasses and reading these words in front of you to them. Right? No, it's got to come from your literal heart, right? The upper domain and the hourglass analogy of your mind, right? Not from your feelings, but from your real heart, your domain of recognition. right, where you testify to what you know. I'm a son of I am. Who are you? Right? You either know that you are, or there's nothing I can do. Now, in terms of what the revelators try to do, you know, to awaken that recognition, they start with some simple things. If they can just get you to remind you of what you know with the first cosmic intuition, like, oh yeah, that's just common sense, isn't it? If they can get you there again, there's two other recognitions right there with that one that are simultaneously awakened, right? And the one knows of the existence of God. It just, so the revelators are constantly doing that. They're not trying to somehow give you some whole rationalization scheme about why there's got to be a God. You know, and they're just trying to get you to open your human eyes. Right? Now, there's nothing that they can give you with words on the page directly for your animal eyes, you know, to get this. Right? They have to inspire you to open your human eyes, your eyes of insight, not your animal eyes of sight.
Yeah. Right? The biggest block I think people have is self-satisfaction.
Yeah. Right, if you're content, right? I mean, Jesus knew that. There's nothing that can be done about that. If the person's completely content, not even, you know, a Michael Son incarnate, you know, can do anything to help, because you have free will and you can effectively absolutize that contentment within yourself and cut yourself off from any input, even the most sublime, like the master literally in your presence, and it has no effect on you. Because again, to see that that's the master in your presence, you have to have your human eyes open. Right? You recognize who he is by your insight, not by your sight. It's not your sight. It's like, well, anyone with a jawbone like that's got to be a, you know, no. Right? That's not how you know. I mean, it's your insight where you know of who that is. Yeah. Anyway, we could go on and on with that, but that's it is those basic elements that it never hurts to reemphasize. It's the kind of challenge that you should be constantly putting before yourself as you read any part of the book. I want to read this paragraph as a human, not as a fancy animal. My animal eyes read, you know, see the words, you know, and process, you know, and I can spit the words out, you know, by jiggle air molecules. Okay, but can I penetrate with my insight and really see the paragraph, not merely see it? Because no matter how fancy the animal, there's no awareness of truth. Only through insight that you can get to truth. No sight can get you to truth.
And experientially, with a revelation like this, it doesn't just happen the first time you look at it.
No.
It's a gradual thing that develops over time.
It's almost like we're in part of an evolutionary process.
Really?
Yeah. So, which brings us back here to the evolutionary process. Right. It's inescapable. Yep.
Well, Gladys was asking earlier, mm-hmm. Just for clarification, you just answered it, but yep. Didn't Lucifer know that Michael was his creator?
But yeah, I mean, how many biologic children fail to respect their biologic parents for the incredible procreative thing that came through them to bring that child into existence? Right? I mean, there should be inherent respect there. Right? But see, again, you have free will. You can overrule anything. if you want to. You know, that's what Lucifer is the poster child for, to show you just how sweepingly you can close your eyes. There's none so blind as those who will not see. He's the poster child for just how definitively, willfully you can close your eyes. Someone with, you know, billions of years of experience with things we can't even imagine, you know, in terms of grandeur. You know, you can close your eyes to all that. You can close your eyes to anything. one little thought about that. Think how natural it is to have your eyes closed like that. If they took you to Havona right now, let alone paradise, you would see nothing. All right, so are your eyes naturally open? No, you have to choose to open them up. It's not there naturally, like you were saying. And it's only by holding that choice present, you know, in other words, it's a genuine choice, not just a decision, that over time you are grown into someone who can see that which you couldn't see before.
And what's interesting is that a lot of time, for a lot of people, it takes the hardships of life, if you want to call it whatever, to get to a point where they begin to open their eyes and look. You know, what did Jesus say? Well, he hasn't had enough stuff happen to him yet to be looking for it, you know. And it happens.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing you said a number of classes ago about the quivering on the brink, you know.
Quivering on the very brink, even.
Is that, and then it talks about another part of the book about, you know, it says an individual or a generation will sometimes, you know, stop the search for God, but it can't last too long because of the part of God that was is within them.
Yeah.
So I am hopeful begin to start. At the bottom and begin to start.
Again, it's very difficult to be lastingly hopeless because of the vast conspiracy of your encirclement, the vast conspiracy of the grace within you. Right? I mean, you have to muster absolute rejection for it to not eventually penetrate your fog.
Both within you and without.
Both within and in the collective phenomenon, yeah. It will, you know, it will come to pass. It's a very rare, I mean, no world ever goes dark, and only a rare individual goes dark. It's a supreme effort. It takes a supreme effort to not be part of eternity. And few can rise to such a challenge. I mean, a fancy animal has no relationship to supremacy. They're just finite. So they're never going to make a negative supreme choice. They're making any kind of thing relative to supremacy, right? You know, they wake up in their ignorance and move on. Okay, meanwhile, back to, guess what? We're going to mention Prince Galagashi. Okay.
The succession of kings was eventually regarded as supernatural, the royal blood being thought to extend back to the times of the materialized staff of Prince Kaligastia. Thus kings became fetish personalities and were inordinately feared, a special form of speech being adopted for court usage. Even in recent times, it was believed that the touch of kings would cure disease, and some Urantia people still regard their rulers as having had a divine origin.
So, you know, you talk about Jesus being a king, you know, if only I could have touched the hem of his garment. You see how some of this stuff feeds into these very ancient notions. You don't appreciate kind of why you have such a powerful visceral response to some of these stories about Jesus. And you need to catch yourself. It's like, wait a minute, I'm getting too fixated on the material. He's not. He didn't come as the material uplifter to cure disease. It's not the point.
However, if you had seen me and seen the Father, would have been cool to see him.
Yeah, right, right. But see, but he who has seen me has seen the Spirit Father. Right? See, again, it's just, you know, how much the material miracles can draw your eye away from the Spirit fact and hence away from the Father. And it's, all these things are insidious. So just, you know, every paragraph, they give you little historical tidbits. It's teaching you something about how, you know, one part of what you are is just an ongoing expression of that ancient thing. Right? It's somehow embedded in our culture and in a sense embedded in you. And it's been reworked into some new mold. Notice just the difficulty we talked about with, well, I know of a lot of very bad examples of kings. And the fact that you have this history where they became basically fetish personalities, how much more problematic it is than when you focus on the negative examples. You know, you don't recognize there's a, you have a spiritual juicing of that negativity that's coming from the historical sense of kings, see? So it powers you even further away, you know, of just absolutely rejecting the notion of a hierarchy, you know, especially of a singular executive. This is the emergency thing. See, I mean, we're spiritual enough that we can have an unfortunate, more energetic spiritual response to things, reject things that we shouldn't reject all the more definitively, all the more zealously than we could before we were spiritually uplifted. See, it's that unfortunate use of the gift that's been given to us, this greater relationship to spirit that we are, it's sad to record, we're using in a negative mode. That's what's leading to the emergency. Right? It's not an emergency that there's tyranny in the material comfort era. That's a universal fact. There's no emergency there. Right? But it is an emergency if you start having unfortunate twisting of your interpretation of that state, you know, where you're using your religious impulse where you shouldn't be using it. You know, you're religiously rejecting singular, you know, executives. You know, you're religiously, but you know, that's the problem. You know, is you're using your sixth adjutant, your religious impulse, for everything except what it's meant for. Like I've brought this up a number of times recently. Just, you know, a little side example. When you first learn about the Master Seraphim, there's especially a pair that everyone remembers. You may not remember all the different groups of Master Seraphim, but everyone remembers two. Right, the Progress Angels and the Religious Guardians, or the Angels of Progress and the Angels of the Churches, as they're often called. Right? And, you know, just ask yourself a simple question. Which, you know, do you feel a more immediate affinity to? The Progress Angels or the Religious Guardians? Okay. You know that, you know, usually the answer is, the Angels of Progress, right? The Progress Angels, not those fuddy-duddy religious guardians. I'm all about progress. Well, that's unfortunate. That leads to an emergency. You're applying your religious impulse to progress. Absolutely destructive to do that. See, I mean, so much so that even when you're talking about Master Seraphim, they have checkmates against that. Right? I mean, that, you know, that's the emergency in a nutshell, applying your religious impulse to the word progress. Right? Your religious impulse is meant for what those religious guardians are doing, not what the angels of progress are doing. Right? And are churches fostering you applying your sixth adjutant to what the religious guardians apply it to? Or are churches fostering, you know, encouraging you to apply it to what the progress angels are about? It shouldn't have anything to do with the sixth adjutant.
groups take turns 100 years at a time?
Right, just, yeah.
They take turns, so are the progressing angels in charge right now?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
they're both going to affect, again,
regardless, you know, regardless of that very objective back and forth between them, right? I mean, for us, it's a simple question. You know, it doesn't matter who's in charge. My job is to use my religious impulse only for genuine religious elements, facts, and nothing else, no other idea. Right? And the moment that I fail in that, I'm going off on a false tangent. And I'm going off geometrically. Starts out fairly innocent, but quickly exponentiates and becomes very problematic. And if enough people on a planet do that, the entire super universe mobilizes to put this book in my lap to send a warning to me and everyone else, you need to stop doing that. Because the kind of checkmate that when humans do that is not the gentle, objective checkmate like the angels of progress have. Those are master seraphim, right? The checkmate for humans is the Most High Observer and the angels of the trumpets and the divine executioners and the... that's the checkmate for humans, you know, getting too off on a tangent. It's very tough medicine.
You're confusing me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm confusing myself. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we use no impulse towards progress?
You don't apply your religious impulse. Yes. You have lots of other impulse.
That's what I'm saying. So
don't
we use
apply.
Other impulse yeah. towards
it. Right. Progress is not the negative.
There's six other adjutants, each have an impulse, right? right? But your religious impulse is not for non-religious things. Like the idea of progress. Or any other thing. I mean, we talk about this all the time. Anything, any idea you take, you stick an ism on it, you know, like militarism, right? Or passivism. It doesn't matter if it's military, you know, or peace. If you take that idea and apply the religious impulse to it, you turn it into an ism, and it's a problem.
So it's the religion.
It isn't revelation a progressive thing.
Sure, it progressive, but not progressivism. See. And that's the thing, you know, it's when you unfortunately bring this religious, what should be for religion, that religious energy, that religious impulse, into play where it shouldn't be, that's what eventually produces emergencies either globally, like we have now, or individually. You'll have an individual emergency, there'll be an individual crisis if you drive yourself horizontally with your religious impulse. Rather than vertically. Eh? Yep.
Then what I'm going to say might not be right. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you apply the religious impulse to what it's not supposed to be applied to.
Mm-hmm.
Then since it multiplies geometrically, then it will go...
it isn't geometrically.
Fanaticism, we all know that doesn't stay in this sort of nice, gentle state. It gets worse and worse and worse until, I mean, usually, you know, someone has to put the person down, right? I mean, the fanatic just becomes so frothy that everyone else has no option but just to drop them. Right? Because there's no off switch on that. It can just froth to just a total catastrophe.
So that was okay to say that if you apply the religious impulse mm-hmm. to what it's not supposed to be mm-hmm. applied to, then it does multiply your
It just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. It can't do anything else. Right? It just, It's not like you penetrate through a difficult time. You know, it's like, well, it's just a difficult adolescence. It's like, no, you're not on a growth path where the analogy of child, adolescent, adult is appropriate. You're going the opposite direction from that direction. You're going away from adolescence. You know, you're going into this, you know, see, you know, if you go pre-child of God, see, what have you done? You've become effectively just fancy animal. And a child of God is a human.
He's not saying that religion doesn't progress.
Right. No, I mean, again, religion, you know, everything progresses. It's an evolutionary phenomenon. Everything progresses. See, it's, the tricky thing is, you know, it's not a dichotomy. You know, the angels of the progress angels and the religious guardians aren't two sides of a dichotomy. They're not enemies. But you know, think about how many people get burning with a passion about progress, and see anyone that suggests the kind of conservative, you know, in the proper sense of the word, not our current political sense of the word, but in a proper sense of the word, you know, what those religious guardians are working on. You know, they see that as an enemy, you know. How dare you hold back progress? You know, it's like, no, I'm not holding back progress. You know, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I'm not holding back progress. I'm trying to conserve value. I'm trying to make sure that the values that have been brought up through the past and exist in the present don't get lost as we progress. I'm trying to keep them going forward into the future. Conserve is about the future, just like progress is about the future. Preserve is about the past. Right? See, again, there's just so little understanding, so we turn it into dichotomies. And anyway.
Question?
Yeah, is there another? Yeah, question?
Okay, so what if you apply your religious progress to artistic progress, like someone like
I mean, again, you want to be fostering everything you're doing to be progressing. That's fine. Nothing wrong with progress. It's just don't let that that zeal get into play there. Be, you know, definitively dedicated to a task, but don't start to turn it into a substitute for religion. A lot of people have done this in various and produced wonderful things. But again, just the revelation is just trying to point out no individual is going to collapse the world, you know, if they get way too zealous and, you know, make some particular endeavor their everything. at the expense of their family. You know, we all know that there's been people that have done really incredible material things, you know, but they lost all their family and everything in the process because they, you know, they were applying their religious impulse, you know, to whatever their endeavor was, and it just destroyed all of their relationships and everything. Right, but they won't bring down the world in doing that. They'll just, you know, create a big mess around them, you know, immediately around them. The emergency is when you get enough people on the leading edge of civilization all doing that together. That's what the revelation is here for. Revelation, there's no individual emergency that would mobilize the super universe. None of us have an individual emergency. Michael took care of that 2,000 years ago. We all get adjusters by grace now. There are no individual emergencies. And like John was saying, eventually those adjusters, you know, help you out in spite of yourself. Right? But there is this collective thing where too many people are willfully closing their eyes to truth and wisdom and applying their religious impulse where it shouldn't be. Because, see, basically when you close your eyes to those things, you're closing your eyes to what the religious impulse should be applied to. You know, you're closing your eyes that look upward. So the only thing you can think of to apply it to is something in the plane. You know, and you pick, like, this direction. This is the direction, right? not that direction over there. You know, and so you just, right, that's the problem.
I try to remember the sequence, origin, history, and destiny.
Mm-hmm.
Here we're learning the origin and history with the implied, which gives us a longer span. We can see the direction where destiny must
mm-hmm.
lie. It's got to be lined up with origin, right. History, and destiny.
Because we're trying to get the truth.
It can't be over there. Mm-hmm. It only can be there mm-hmm. if we know our origin and history. If we forget,
yeah.
then we're really lost.
Right.
That's the
problem of those who get so fixated on progress. They know nothing of origin and history, and they're just fixated on destiny. And what does it say about those kind of people? Oh, they're kind of people that regret the past, whine over the present, and vainly hope for the future. Right? See, when all you fixate is on the destiny, you're vainly hoping the future. You're not going to get it. There's no, you're not aligned with the truth, like you're saying. It's only when you have origin, history, and destiny encompassed together, is there any truth in your understanding of the situation? See, in that we have more and more people blinding themselves.
Regret past.
Regret the past, whine over the present, and vainly hope for the future.
Rage.
Why do the heathen rage, right? Yeah.
Just to have a similar thing about the religious impulse. You don't want to use it zealously and wrongly, but you use it for everything, I would think.
Again, zeal has its place. Zeal for ideals.
But you use the religious impulse.
But not ideas.
Everything in life.
But, you initiate things with the original, because your evolutionary stream of ideas are evolving toward an ideal. Right? And you recognize that ideal with your spiritual insight, and you are zealous for that ideal. But you're not zealous for an idea at any point. You know that they're just means to an end. None of them are an end in themselves. The moment you start to think of a particular idea as being an end in itself, you've falsely elevated it to an ideal. You're applying your religious impulse to an idea instead of the ideal. See, and these are not easy things. I mean, you can't look up the word ideal properly in the dictionary. You can't even look up the word idea properly in the dictionary. 2,600 years of philosophers trying to figure out what the word idea means, and they haven't figured it out yet. It's only in the fifth epical revelation that we finally have the proper definition of the word idea. These are not easy things we're talking about here. They're quite abstract, quite difficult to achieve. But at least you can, even if you don't understand in precise fashion what an idea is, what an ideal is, you at least have the sense that an idea, that an ideal is transcendent, right? And the ideas are oriented toward that transcendent ideal. You at least have that notion.
So Terry, what are the questions?
Just let me say the last part. You kind of like flavor the ideas as you're going through with the religious impulse. Is how.
See, you're zealous for your destiny. But you're not zealous for your origin or history.
You use your wisdom.
Not zealous.
Your religious side is saying, okay, I see this thing, I'm gone, But your brain, your smarts, your experience, your wisdom has got to teach you a little bit what's the reality of doing that? One of the other things they talk about in the book is the fact that when we get too ahead of ourselves, mechanically, intellectually, or whatever, with technology and stuff like that, and religion or the spiritual side doesn't keep up with it, we've got another problem. And that happens today a lot. Everybody believes that they can achieve all this stuff immediately, through technology. So it's very conscious that way. But they've sort of thrown out the baby with the bathwater. Right? And God has taken, lucky if he's in the back seat.
Right. Again, that's just yet another example of technology becomes a substitute for God, right? And you have technologyism, right? And where it's a complete lifestyle solution, right? It's our salvation,
So it doesn't mean you disregard your religious zeal. It just means you've got to, you know, and I'm sure you do this, but I mean, you've got to use your, I call them your smarts, your wisdom, whatever, to know, you know, at what point and how, you know, how much you do. I mean, Lucifer's big problem, which we sometimes forget, is that he tried to do it all in his time. He wanted to do it, boom, what the whole thing Chris always says, what do you want, fill in the blank? Well, his blank was big, and when do you want it now? So, and that was because, you know, he didn't want to follow the rules, so to speak, and felt that he was, you know, God, could make it happen. And because, you know, because you remember when you read about it, he keeps on saying, well, I see all this happening, so why do I have to wait for it to happen? Why do I have to do it, you know, the way that is ordained, so to speak? And I think that's one of the things you're trying to make a little bit. If you follow that particular path without, and you don't bring behind you, much like the angels of the churches are really supposed to try and bring the good that's come out of the, you know, the church's religion and bring that forward rather than discard that and, you know, with just progress. And I think that's one of the things he's trying to say is, and what are those things that are being discarded that are important, you know? Some of them need to be discarded, that's true, but what are the ones that aren't, that are important to bring forward? You know, for us trying to spread the revelation to people, those are kinds of things we need to think about and how we, you know, deal with people and deal with the religions of the world as we move forward and bring forth, you know, the good that's there and while the bad sort of trickles away.
It's so complicated. We could go on and on. I mean, just, you know, just the whole fact of religion, right? See, I mean, no one even knows what the word religion, you know, the genuine religion is. So, you know, like, let's say you use the term religious zeal. Well, you got to recognize that no one actually knows what, you know, you're properly referring to there. I mean, we think of religion as some outer life thing they're going to be zealous about. No, genuine religion has nothing to do with the outer life. Right? So, you know, proper religious zeal is not something that's understood. I mean, what we, you know, historical examples of religious zeal are not religious zeal. They're ideological zeal. We have ideologies. Those are outer life things. Religion has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with the outer life, right? It has to do with a domain that is not really written about in all of human history, the domain that's transcendent of feelings, right? Like you hear me say all the time, you know, your feelings about the outer life is not your inner life, right? I mean, being zealous about your feelings, see, that's not, right? That's what is often called religious zeal. No, that's not religious zeal, right? You have to just back up. You know, the revelation is trying to challenge us to back up, erase everything, and start all over again, right? And it starts with a definition of terms. What's the first paper in the book? A definition of terms, right? Yeah, you can't get anywhere with this, the philosophic effort that the fifth epical revelation is challenging you to do, if you don't have terms, or at least a recognition of your ignorance of terms. That, you know what? Guess what? I don't even know what the word truth or value, or spirit, or religion, or
idea.
We could just go on and on. And that's not just me. Humans don't. Humans have been reflecting for centuries trying to figure out the definition of these words and haven't gotten anywhere. Because, see, you fundamentally can't without revelation. Right? The proper definition of the words that we use comes from revelation. It doesn't come bottom up. It's not the human philosophy, the lower hemisphere. It's the metaphysics. It's the divine revelation. It's the upper hemisphere of the sphere of philosophy. It has to be given to you. You can't figure it out on your own. You can't get the top upper hemisphere from the bottom up. And none of us are descending sons. We don't have immediate access to the top down. It has to be given to us.
And at the bottom, you can't really descend.
And if you just read this book, you know, in the old wineskins, right, where you think that all the words in this book can be looked up in the dictionary, you're putting new wine in old wineskins. You're not going to get anything except just kind of a complexified, you know, child of God thing happening. But that's the thing. I mean, the fourth epical revelation is about fostering the existence of children of God instead of just fancy animals. That's the fourth epical revelation. The fifth epical revelation is not about merely children of God. It's about adults of God. Right? And adults have to have...
Or at least adolescents.
Children don't need the word spirit defined. Children don't need the word religion defined. But adults do. Adults of God must know, right, that spirit is not feeling, that religion is not feeling, that the heart is not feeling, that everything we're thinking about is transcendent of feelings. Right? Is God worth thinking about? Is it your feelings that lead you Godward? No, it's something transcendent of feelings. The domain that you can't read about in any book, because it's really not recognized, the existence of it is not known consciously. The whole upper domain in the hourglass analogy, there are no feelings in the upper domain. It's transcendent of feelings. The feelings are in the lower domain. Activity in the upper domain casts a shadow down and produces feelings, right? Activity in the upper domain applies feelings, but feelings don't apply to the upper domain. Right? The best philosophers recognize that there's a material, external world, an outer material, outer life, and a parallel stream of feelings about that outer life, and that's the best we've ever gotten. There's something transcendent. The real human consciousness is above that. Right? And it's unexplored territory consciously. It's always been there superconsciously by grace, and we reap the benefits of it, you know, unwittingly. But it's sad to record that so few persons on your rancha take delight in cultivating the upper domain being part of your conscious mind instead of just your superconscious mind. And you live off the shadows that it casts, right, in your conscious life. That's what the fifth epical revelation is about. Reflective thinking. You know, what kind of thoughts lead you Godward? I mean, basal thoughts? No. Transcendent thoughts. Vertically oriented thoughts. Upwardly vertically oriented thoughts. Reflective thinking is the doorway to God. Okay. Back to the kings. Who were apparently descending sons. They did have divine origin, it says. So they... okay. All right, so yeah, if anyone can remember where we were, that's where we were. We were talking about the kings there. Okay.
The early fetish king was often kept in seclusion. He was regarded as too sacred to be viewed except on feast days and holy days. Ordinarily, a representative was chosen to impersonate him. And this is the origin of prime ministers. The first cabinet officer was a food administrator. Others shortly followed. Rulers soon appointed representatives to be in charge of commerce and religion. And the development of a cabinet was a direct step toward depersonalization of executive authority. These assistants of the early kings became the accepted nobility, and the king's wife gradually rose to the dignity of queen as women came to be upheld in higher esteem.
See, so John, there's the queen thing, like I said. So you can see, I mean, it took a while for that concept to have a parallel dignity. And the language points that out. Right? There's not, you know, you don't have two parallel ing words. See? You know, it's not like you have a you know, an archetype male ing word and an archetype female ing word. See? It's just you know, all just one, you know, they're all just lumped together in kin, and that has a positive aspect to it. You know, don't think of that as just an unfortunate historical negativity. Our personalities don't have gender. Our animal origin selves have gender. Right? So the more transcendent, the more you function as a human, the more you transcend, you know, that differential that in literal expression we leave behind in very short order in our ascension career. Right? You don't leave behind the evolutionary acquirement differential, but right. We're not males and females for very long. In a literal sense. Okay, now again, just notice the conspiracy that they're alluding to. You know, you think about wow, it's a really advanced thing to finally have the concept of a parliament and a prime minister relative to some primitive thing. See, look at how it, you know, the whole bit with fetish kings, and it's like, you know, you have to keep them sequestered and all that. And there's this vast conspiracy that just inexorably is starting to get a legislature separated, right, from an executive, so just that's what they're trying to get you to recognize. Let's see. What else did we have there? Oh,
commerce.
Yeah. Notice commerce and religion. See, you know, it's a long time before you have the separation of church and state, right? So you have a secretary of commerce and a secretary of religion, you know, as it were. Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Because you know, you notice that. You know, why was the first cabinet officer a food administrator? Let me think. Which is the first developmental epic? Could it be
nutrition.
The nutrition epic? Yes. Right. See, again, you want to be able to notice all that stuff yourself, just like I bring out. I mean, the pattern is just always there. All right.
Unscrupulous rulers gained great power by the discovery of poison. Early court magic was diabolical. The king's enemies soon died.
Problem solved.
Don't cross the king. But even the most despotic tyrant was subject to some restrictions. He was at least restrained by the ever-present fear of assassination. The medicine men, witch doctors, and priests have always been a powerful check on the kings. Subsequently, the landowners, their aristocracy, exerted a restraining influence. And ever and anon, the clans and tribes would simply rise up and overthrow their despots and tyrants. Deposed rulers, when sentenced to death, were often given the option of committing suicide, which gave origin to the ancient social vogue of suicide in certain circumstances.
See, so you know, even though they've risen up and overthrown him, I mean, that fetish king thing is pretty powerful.
Hands
off. You see, so often, you know, yeah, right. Yeah. He's like, well, I want to kill you, but boy, I don't know if I want to mess with the taboo things there that I could fall into. Right, so. Why don't you just do yourself in?
I'm suddenly suicidal.
Yes, yeah. I was joking about the whole. You know, one hopes that the board of directors doesn't remove the CEO by poison. Notice the strong word they threw in there. Early court magic was diabolical. That's a pretty striking word to throw in there. So in other words, just as wicked as you can imagine.
Well, they say that about Herod, even. Remember when they're talking to Jesus? He, no big deal for him to kill his.
You know, and even, you know, in the early days of the papacy, you know, it was a soap opera in the court, you know. The other thing there, just a little aside, you notice how they're challenging you to look up and reflect on the specific difference between despot and tyrant. You know, they start out with despotic tyrants, and you're thinking, well, why didn't they say tyrannical despots? Why did they say despotic tyrants? and, you know, and then they really make the point when they say they're despots and tyrants. It's like, wow, what's the difference between the two? I always thought of them as synonyms. See, they aren't exactly synonyms. You know, we often blur them together. You know, the dictionary, well, you look up tyrant, it'll say despot. You look up despot, it'll say tyrant. Right? You got to get to the etymology. You got to look at it more literally. The despot is emphasizing the domination element. I mean, despotic and masterful are kind of synonyms. Not masterly, but the dominant, you know, the very oppressive dominance word masterful, and we also blur those together and say masterful when we mean masterly. The revelators don't, but we do. Whereas tyrant, so instead of emphasizing that, you know, that dominance, you know, from this elevated estate in the hierarchy, you know, it's emphasizing the non-relativity, the absoluteness of how the individual sees himself. Right. So,
kind of like a narcissist.
So whether or not they're in this kind of dominance, you know, top-down dominance mode, or thinking of themselves in too absolutist a terms, right? Despots and tyrants. Yeah. And I don't, you know, I don't want to be pedantic about this. But it's important. I mean, you can see that the revelators want you to actually think like that, or they wouldn't have, you know, they would have just used one word. They're wanting you to get more precise. You have lots of religious impulse. They're taking that for granted. They know if you don't, you're not going to have opened the book in the first place. But you probably don't have the requisite precision of thought to put in parallel with all of that, you know, animation in you. Okay, can you take a hold of the reins, pull back a little bit, slow it down, right, and methodically think precisely, get this science to combine with your religion, so that you can get to super additive consequence. That's science, the difference between despot and tyrant. Etymology is a science.
Something okay. About it that's top down. You know there is. And just for you to say one is more like the hierarchy, the vertical,
mm-hmm.
And the other one is more like absolute.
Yeah. I'm the only one on the plane, right? Yeah. Yeah. See, just, you know, the... And you could be more precise, you know. It's like, well, I'm thinking there's a negative element to this leader. You know, is it despotic or is it tyrannical? Right. Okay. I hope I don't get too tedious with bringing up stuff like that a lot. But I'm just it's important. I'm trying to be true to what the revelators are challenging here by holding up these things. You know, have you not read, you know, that it said despotic tyrant? What the heck? Why are they being redundant?
I'm going to take a week and unpack.
All right. So now you were talking about how you have these, you know, subgroups, subsets. As we move forward, we don't literally have such a consanguineous clan phenomenon. You're still going to have these, you know, these subgroups.
Section 7, primitive clubs and secret societies. It seems like it's an aside they're taking.
But they're not. I was trying to set it up a little bit.
Blood kinship determined the first social groups. Association enlarged the kinship clan. Intermarriage was the next step in group enlargement, and the resultant complex tribe was the first true political body. The next advance in social development was the evolution of religious cults and the political clubs. These first appeared as secret societies and originally were wholly religious. Subsequently, they became regulative. At first, they were men's clubs. Later, women's groups appeared. Presently, they became divided into two classes, socio-political and religio-mystical.
Okay, I think, you know, everyone probably has lots of visualizations of this. Everyone knows something about primitive clubs and secret societies. Maybe just one little note. First true political body. Here it is again. You're like, what the heck do they mean? What is the literal meaning of political? Anyway, they keep challenging this. Right? You know, what's the difference between something that's called a political body and something that's a true political body? Well, they must be referring to the literal proper meaning of the word political. Right, you don't have just the naturalness of like they say, blood kinship. Right? You have a bigger group that transcends blood kinship, and so you have true citizens of that bigger group now. Right? That's, you know, that the root there of political. It's about how, you know, you're a citizen. You know, think about how that word citizen doesn't come into play until you've got something that's not just such a mindless sort of automatic natural genetic phenomenon.
Right? From natural to artificial.
Yes, see, going up to something that's more mind-made and personality-managed, you know, in a more conscious way. Okay. Do you have this resultant complex tribe? Okay. What else they say here?
There were many reasons for the secrecy of these societies, such as 1, fear of incurring the displeasure of the rulers because of the violation of some taboo. 2, in order to practice minority religious rites. 3, for the purpose of preserving valuable spirit or trade secrets. 4, for the enjoyment of some special charm or magic.
Notice that they put quotes around the word spirit. It's like I'm saying all the time, you know, there's lots of people that have used that word, but that's quote-unquote spirit that they're thinking of, not genuine spirit. But you have to kind of chuckle, you know, so it's quote-unquote spirit, and then the word valuable, you know, value is a spirit word, you know, so it's like, actually you should have quotes on that. It's like, quote-unquote valuable, quote-unquote spirit. Right, but nonetheless, you know, in the same way that they, when they said, and originally were wholly religious, yeah, well, quote unquote religious, right? I mean, you know, what passes in the early stages of evolution? I mean, we know superconsciously that there's a reality domain that the word religion is supposed to be applied to. But instead of looking for it transcendently, you know, vertically up, we're looking for it horizontally in the outer life, like I was saying. You know. But nonetheless, right? You know, all this foolishness going on in the outer life that's called religious. You know, if you look at it with insight, you can see that it actually does tie back unconsciously, superconsciously to what we have by grace, that encirclement by grace. And so it's in truth religious, even if it's not consciously, in fact, religious. They're just pointing out some of these four different elements that inescapably See, like I said, yeah, even when you leave the whole blood kinship thing behind, inescapably there are phenomena that push the greater grouping into a subsetting mode, you know, even into a secret subsetting mode, right? Okay, what else do they say here?
It's interesting, taboo. It's like the taboos were so ironclad,
yep,
there was no room to maneuver. And so you have a secret society that gives you some relief from the taboo, but there's fear involved there too. It helps weld the secret society together.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can think about how incompatible taboo and tolerance are. Right, you know, taboo is very absolutist, you know. So.
The very secrecy of these societies conferred on all members the power of mystery over the rest of the tribe. Secrecy also appeals to vanity. The initiates were the social aristocracy of their day. After initiation, the boys hunted with the men, whereas before they had gathered vegetables with the women. And it was the supreme humiliation, a tribal disgrace, to fail to pass the puberty tests and thus be compelled to remain outside the men's abode with the women and children, to be considered effeminate. Besides, non-initiates were not allowed to marry.
Okay, now it's getting serious. It's one thing to be to have the supreme humiliation of being considered effeminate, but just quickly there, reflect on it again. It's like, okay, so you take these facts from the past forward, and what kind of shadows, if you will, do they still cast? Right, and bringing up that considered effeminate, you see, supreme humiliation. It's like, no wonder we have very difficult tensions still today. They're reminding you of why this is still so problematic. That you have variations in the nature of males. So just. They shouldn't have to spoon feed that, spell it out for you. You should be able to go, oh, yeah. You know, and none of us are aware of why we get so worked up, you know, why some people have such knee-jerk, impassioned reactions. It's just rooted in very ancient, training. And it's just very difficult for humans to actually stake a claim in a whole new space where there isn't still some basic dynamic like that going on, right? To totally leave that behind. It's very, very difficult. All right.
Primitive people very early taught their adolescent youths sex control. It became the custom to take boys away from parents from puberty to marriage, their education and training being entrusted to the men's secret societies. And one of the chief functions of these clubs was to keep control of adolescent young men, thus preventing illegitimate children.
Okay. Again, do I need to spell it out? I mean, what's the truth that's flowing through that? It's like, well, that's those primitive people. We're genetically totally different now. We can ignore all the evolutionary discoveries, all the wisdom. No, of course not, right? I mean, primitive people very early taught their adolescent youths sex control. Why? Because they very early learned something that's still true today. Right? You see how that's the whole point of all these, what's the truth flowing through? And do we have some new structure? Are there institutions or whatever, right, that handle these facts? Or we just believe that, oh no, boys are innately divine now, unlike in primitive times, and They're totally self-managing without any issues. It's like, seriously? What kind of delusional thought is that?
Where was I when that happened?
No. I mean, you know, and they're giving you the details, you know, showing you, they recognized you needed to be very definitive about this. I mean, it became the custom to take boys away from parents from puberty and marriage. It's like, wow, this is like, we just have to like sequester them practically, right? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, to think primitively about this would be, oh, so they're saying we should reinstitute that. No, right? Not the fact, right? Don't reinstitute the fact of it. Recognize the truth of it and produce an institution that that same truth is flowing through, that recognizes, that faces facts and adjusts them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom.
The military.
Right, something. We have to have, right, you have to do something. You can't ignore, I mean, there's no off switch on that basic biologic instinct to sex hunger in a male. It's just, you can't pretend it doesn't exist. Like we're sort of rediscovering again in recent times here. Oh my goodness. who could know?
Who'd have thought?
Who'd have thought?
Right? It means we don't have anything like this. So we should bring it back.
Right, we have to have something, or you end up with just a social calamity.
It is a
right?
One after another.
Lives on both sides destroyed, right? Because there's no structure. You know, just because you have laws now doesn't mean you don't still need a mores system. For the things that shouldn't be codified in law, the way we, you know, basically govern ourselves in our social interactions and stuff. We have to have some sort of a system.
We have the incompatible thoughts of equality of the sexes and sex slaves in the same mind.
Yeah. You know, and again, that's there. I mean, at the foundational level of the two sexes, there's not equality, right? You know, you don't have a maternal instinct on one side and a paternal instinct on the other side, you know, that sort of parallel, quote-unquote, equality. No, there is no such thing. It's, you know, very different at the foundation. You have to face that fact. You can't pretend that, you know, that males don't need a very definitive social regulation ingrained into them when they're young, right? I mean, again, I mean, elephants know this. And when we somehow don't anymore. I mean, elephants know the difference between young males and young females and know that they need to be more definitive about, you know, getting the males so that they don't become rogue males. I mean, even the elephants, you know, differentiate like this. I mean, that's just how ridiculous we've become. All right.
Commercialized prostitution began when these men's clubs paid money for the use of women from other tribes. But the earlier groups were remarkably free from sex laxity.
Because, of course, they were trying to deal with sex laxity, see? It was just giving you that little corollary paragraph so you can see how the two fit together, see? All right.
The puberty initiation ceremony usually extended over a period of 5 years. Much self-torture and painful cutting entered into these ceremonies. Circumcision was first practiced as a rite of initiation into one of these secret fraternities. The tribal marks were cut on the body as a part of the puberty initiation. The tattoo originated as such a badge of membership. Such torture, together with much privation, was designed to harden these youths, to impress them with the reality of life and its inevitable hardships. This purpose is better accomplished by the later appearing athletic games and physical contests.
Okay, so they kind of spell that one out.
But it's still necessary.
Yeah. but again, just, you know, remember in the marriage and family papers how they talk about premarital disillusionment. Right? You know, just pre-life disillusionment, right? Being pounded into them in, you know, very crude, you know, even savage ways, right, initially, because they're savages to start with. Right? But nonetheless, you know, even though they had very primitive solutions to the problem, they recognized the problem, and it's an inescapable problem. You know, just notice the wisdom in them that they're trying to solve the problem, even if they have very crude ways of going about it. There's nonetheless a wisdom there. There's no wisdom when you think, well, there's no problem at all, and we don't need to do anything. It's all just, you know, happens magically and wonderfully. Yeah, so it's, and just little evolutions like, well, you know, maybe actually using a knife to carve something in. How about if we just tattoo them instead? You know, see, you know, the evolution from savage to barbarian, you know. I mean, initially they were branding, you know, too, and you know, you went to tattoos. Anyway, okay.
But the secret societies did aim at the improvement of adolescent morals. One of the chief purposes of the puberty ceremonies was to impress upon the boy that he must leave other men's wives alone.
Paragraph all to itself again. see, so, I mean, again, there's a great example there of, you know, taking just that one little thought and making it a paragraph to itself, not because there's a lot of very, very complicated things, you know, and you basically need to parse it one sentence at a time. No, they're just trying to, it's a bullet point, you know, to highlight that, so it doesn't get lost in some bigger paragraph. Right? This is a very important issue.
Boys will be boys.
Oh, no, I don't. I think naturally they'll leave other men's wives alone. No. There's no instinct for that. None. Right? I mean, you know, if you've ever watched a movie or a documentary about the way, say, a group of gorillas function or a group of chimpanzees, are they innately monogamous? Right. So again, just trying to point out what should be trivially obvious. You know, yeah.
I was thinking the 1800s had kind of a code like that, and it started to break down more in the 1900s, where it's just a free for all, and there's no guidance like that.
Yeah.
Which is why we have all this coming out now, with one after another getting losing their job. And
yeah, yeah. You can just, you know, see how there's. It's very easy to find things like, wow, that's not primitivism. That's pre-primitivism. Yes, it is. It's just, we have so many things that we're pretending that somehow it just all magically works, and it doesn't. One has to have very definitive, consciously initiated and maintained structures, or it all just falls apart.
Yeah. Following these years of rigorous discipline and training, and just before marriage, the young men were usually released for a short period of leisure and freedom, after which they returned to Marion to submit to lifelong subjection to the tribal taboos.
Okay, how much which foreign potentate imposed that on me?
Life is over at this point. And this ancient custom was continued down to modern times as the foolish notion of sowing wild oats.
Again, it's pretty straightforward. Everyone recognizes what's going on here. But you notice how it's like, okay, let's take this little thought, highlight it. Okay, then the next little, what should be trivially obvious thought, let's highlight it. I mean, you know, they know who they're talking to. right? They know that these most rudimentary things were just like blinded to them now. Throwing out a word like foolish. It's like, ooh, I don't like it when someone paints me with that word. Well, then don't think like that. But it's natural to think like that. Yeah, that's the whole point. Civilization's not natural. It's artificial. You have to choose to be civilized. Right? And you notice up front here, we're just talking about males. We'll get to females in a little bit here. Everyone knows that when things start to unravel, the males are the spear point. It's all lost when the women follow suit and lose all civilized behavior. But the men always are, are stepping into it, right? So they're leading with that reminder.
Just go on taking that a little bit further.
Yep.
I remember when I was in my 20s or my late 20s, and there was this ranch.
You can remember that far back?
He was really cool and young, and he and his wife, he was having a birthday, and he and his wife wanted to do this thing where everybody went to a group of men dancers, and you put like a dollar. It was
Go-Go Boys.
The what?
Go-Go Boys.
It was like
Chippendales.
A male review, yes.
It was like crying, and so we all went together, and it was like 20 of us.
And why did everyone go? Because it's the custom, right? I mean, anyway, right? We all get it. Yeah, it just it's just it is very difficult. I mean, it was Gene did a great job of parsing that paragraph as he read it. Just the tension that's there, right? That every male recognizes. That lifelong subjection to the tribal taboos. each gender has its Achilles heel, right? And needs when you get in the marriage family papers, they're pretty aggressive with the women, in terms of the Achilles heel there. How their newfound freedom could go very, very poorly if they don't rise to the challenge, just like the freedom for guys, goes very immediately and always has very poorly, unless they challenge themselves. That can you have liberty without license? Can you have liberty in law? Or are you going to fall into that greatest problem with the Lucifer Rebellion, the difference between true and false liberty? Right. And sometimes it's expressed in very material, basal ways, right? But nonetheless, there's a general issue there of false liberty.
I took liberties, now I have in-laws.
Uh-huh, okay.
Many later tribes sanctioned the formation of women's secret clubs, the purpose of which was to prepare adolescent girls for wifehood and motherhood. After initiation, girls were eligible for marriage and were permitted to attend the bride show, the coming out party of those days. Women's orders pledged against marriage early came into existence.
Okay, so in both cases, you have a parallel. You have the secret society thing fostering this, but there's those that, one way or another, end up on the outside. with the males, you know, this, you know, they've got shoved out. You know, you can see with the females, it's more, you know, I think I'm just going to opt out of that whole wifehood and motherhood thing, because that sounds like lifelong subjection to the tribal taboos to me. See? It's the same thing. Right? We all know that's still in play. You know, why do I have to, you know, submit myself to any sort of structure? Can't it just be all about me? Doesn't matter if it's male or female, there's a tension there. Okay.
Presently, non-secret clubs made their appearance when groups of unmarried men and groups of unattached women formed their separate organizations. These associations were really the first schools, and while men's and women's clubs were often given to persecuting each other, some advanced tribes, after contact with the Dalmatia teachers, experimented with coeducation, having boarding schools for both sexes.
Yes, yeah, so you can see there's all kinds of fun things there. You know, notice again the fun sort of conspiracy in the evolutionary process again, of you know, you end up with these they're not going to be secret, you know, but non-secret clubs now of these unmarried men and unattached women, and what does it end up producing? The first schools. Right? So it's sort of just this, again, this, you know, you think, oh, this is kind of going in a very unfortunate way. It's like, no. The Supreme can work with any set of facts to take it to where we need to go. Schools need to come into existence. Well, coincidentally, here's a way we can get schools to come into existence. Right? It's not the way you would have planned in advance, right, or anything, but nonetheless. So just notice the vast conspiracy that there's, you know, an individuality to the whole, right? And the fix is in. All facts are going to be taken to the desired end.
This was a long time ago.
Yeah, and then they're just bringing in. Now, it doesn't have to be literally 500,000 years ago, because, well, you know, some places.
200,000 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, some places it was a long time until any Dalmatia influence got to them or something, you know. But nonetheless. What's the truth there? I mentioned it a while back. There's some things you can't figure out on your own. Right? It has to come from revelation, whether it's first epical revelation or whatever. Okay? That's between the lines there.
You've got to love, they say, really the first school.
Yeah. And again, just noticing really or true, you know, when they use real or true. And don't just blow through those words. In other words, there's something human there, even if it's sort of not that consciously recognized, but nonetheless.
Secret societies contributed to the building up of social castes, chiefly by the mysterious character of their initiations. The members of these societies first wore masks to frighten the curious away from their mourning rites, ancestor worship. Later, this ritual developed into a pseudo-seance at which ghosts were reputed to have appeared. The ancient societies of the, quote, new birth used signs and employed a special secret language. They also forswore certain foods and drinks. They acted as night police and otherwise functioned in a wide range of social activities.
Remember when they said, you know, originally they were wholly religious, you know, just, you know, and they say things like the ancient societies of the new birth used signs and employed a special secret language, you know, and they also forswore certain foods and drinks. I mean, just think about how many things like that get incorporated into religious dogmas, you know, and stuff, yeah. And, you know, ritualistic practices, and get exalted into these sort of existential notions, you know.
All secret associations imposed an oath, enjoined confidence, and taught the keeping of secrets. These orders awed and controlled the mobs. They also acted as vigilante societies, thus practicing lynch law.
Not vigilante, vigilance.
Vigilance society.
they're watching, okay?
I really did misread that.
Yep. I believed you, though, because I wasn't really reading it. It sounded good to me.
They were the first spies when the tribes were at war, and the first secret police during times of peace. Best of all, they kept unscrupulous kings on the anxious seat. To offset them, the kings fostered their own secret police.
Yeah, you just see all the dynamics, you know, just all, how, you know, all these things came into existence, you know, just a little thumbnail sketch, they're giving you all that. You notice that they're also pointing out, initially you just had raw taboo as of, you know, the definitive regulating influence. But see, it's getting a little more complicated. It's not just taboo. These orders awed and controlled the mobs. Right, these groups are taking on, you know, this powerful, mysterious, mystical thing, you know, everyone that submits themselves to, right? So, and again, like we've talked about so many times, the fact that we aren't as subject to this kind of influence, it's like, well, so how are we going to be regulated now? Especially if we reject having the law written in our hearts. How's this going to work? You know, you throw out superstition and you throw out self-control.
They'll come up with a pill.
Yeah, you know, people have written stories about this. They've reflected on this. Well, I think the only solution, you know, is to just, you know, use, you know, drugs and medicate everyone down into a passive state. Yeah, you know, we all know there's lots of stories in recent times have been written about that. It's not like people haven't thought about, it's like, well, where is this going? You know, how are we going to be, you know, how is this not all going to just, you know, descend into anarchistic chaos here? Right?
Well, that was thought to be the solution to unwanted pregnancies, the pill.
Yes, yeah. And again, you know, we've overplayed science an awful lot. Right, you know, thinking that all of our problems can be solved from the outside in. No. You know, the real solutions start from the inside, go out. We have to remember, it's not science that's the initiator, it's religion that's the initiator. Genuine religion. See, so again, you know, if religion is just yet another outside in thing, right, it's not religion. It's ideology.
Self-mastery religion, basically.
Right. I mean, it starts with the inside and goes out. That's genuine self-mastery. You know, rather than being
overcoming just natural
dominated from the outside tendencies. In. Yeah, right. You know, and again, it's all those natural tendencies are in the lower domain, in the hourglass analogy. You know, that's what's attuned to your genetics. And it's the upper domain that you have to, you know, take delight in cultivating, having a conscious, being part of your conscious life, and that it imposes spirit over mind over matter, right? The top-down dominance gets things under control, right? But see, that's not even a possibility when you think that this deep, you know, if you go to your deepest part within, you get to feelings. No, the real you is deeper than your feelings. And there is no self-mastery potential with merely feelings. I mean, everyone knows that feelings lead to emotions, which is the antithesis of self-mastery, right? Yeah, it's totally, you're out of control, right? Dominated by your emotions. Okay.
These societies gave rise to the first political parties. The first party government was the strong versus the weak. In ancient times, a change of administration only followed civil war, abundant proof that the weak had become strong.
I see, so, yeah. How do you figure out who's the strong and the weak? Well, you have a civil war. And, and then it's obvious. The ones that are still alive are the strong.
Vote with their sword.
Very straightforward.
It's interesting, though, implied in there, though, is a natural tendency of the weak to become strong. I don't exactly know how that works. But.
Well, again, you notice it's quote unquote the strong and quote unquote the weak, right?
Yeah.
So, it's right. There's all of this, this belief that such and so is strong and so is weak, but not really.
Well, people in power often become careless, mm-hmm. and
right. Yeah. They were once strong. That's how they got into power. But they've dropped their guard, and now they're technically weak, and that shows itself when they're no longer in power because they're overthrown and the guillotines come out or whatever,
These clubs were employed by merchants to collect debts and by rulers to collect taxes. Taxation has been a long struggle, one of the earliest forms being the tithe, one-tenth of the hunt or spoils. Taxes were originally levied to keep up the king's house, but it was found that they were easier to collect when disguised in an offering for the support of the temple service.
Again, it's handy that you haven't separated church and state yet. You can kind of just leverage off this, you have to chuckle. Why is it that Congress can't just, pass a tax bill, in 5 minutes? Taxation has been a long struggle. Very timely. All right, how do they finish up here?
By and by, these secret associations grew into the first charitable organizations and later evolved into the earlier religious societies, the forerunners of churches. Finally, some of these societies became intertribal, the first international fraternities.
So see how it starts out as this phenomenon where you're taking the tribe and you're forming this subgroup and even sequestering it, in the secrecy. It seems like a negative tendency. But again, the Supreme can work with anything. And what does the Supreme eventually do with that, the first international fraternities, right? Think about the Lions Club, say. When you get into these charitable organizations, that go as and become international fraternities.
Doctors Without Borders.
Endless. And of course, it very much got that sort of evolution got amped up significantly when the fifth adjutant dawned in the collective and the middle of the 19th century. We all know that, you got a lot more dynamics, in what they're talking about in that last paragraph, because you have just so much more upfront energy in the energy of socialization. So, anyway. There's lots and lots of details in there, and one of the things that we definitely saw kept coming out was we progress in spite of ourselves, because we are inescapably subject to this overarching evolutionary purpose.
Or we haven't progressed
very far. And those purposes reach their ends because those purposes, no part can thwart. And the whole wins.
I need the house.
So it's, there's a... there's some good news again, in there, right? I mean, just be patient, It looks like it's all going to hell in a handbasket, but, there's an evolutionary process, and it can't be ultimately thwarted. Right? It will take whatever the set of facts is, no matter how debased it might seem, and it will take it through some circuitous path to the purposeful end.
That's like the last paragraph.
So, trust. trust in the evolutionary process, right? Okay, so we'll see more on this subgrouping phenomenon in the next section on social classes. So continuing in that mode. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.